The Vienna Game, written by Paratactician, read by Codeswitch. Chapter 4, Parameters. The mechanics of Imperial Succession had always been reassuringly straightforward. Every so often, a female troll would hatch with blood that was a vivid Tyrian purple. From the moment she wriggled out into the birthing caverns and blinked her adorable eyes, this troll would be treated as hot shit. She'd be coddled and guarded and given the best education and the best food and the prettiest dresses. She might even be invited to the imperial court and given some sort of honorary position that didn't actually require her to do any work other than turning up to parties. Eventually, when she made it to a suitable age, usually somewhere around the 9-sweet mark, she would challenge the current empress to single combat. If she won this duel, which was, beneath the preposterous brocaded layers of pomp and ritual and formality, a bar fight with pretensions, she became the new empress. If she lost, she died, and everything went back to normal until the next one came along. This system satisfied some deep and primal need in the troll collective psyche. It had only ever been seriously called into question once. The succession was by no means automatic. It was quite common for a Tyrian princess to die during childhood, the deep oceans were dangerous, or to lose the crucial duel. But the turnaround was fairly reliable all the same. The longest reign on record had lasted for 94 sweeps, and 50 or 60 was considered average. This was healthy because it gave the empire enough stability to expand, in that long-term military campaigns could be undertaken without too much risk that a new empress would change direction halfway through, while also avoiding stagnation and decay. Such, at least, was the principle of the thing. This had served the empire very well until the accession of the current empress. Her imperious condescension was, without a doubt, the most calculating, brutal, and merciless ruler the empire had ever seen. Such qualities in a leader were warmly regarded by trolls under normal circumstances. But the Condess, as she was generally known, had actually proved a little too ruthless, even for the system which had spawned her. Tyrian blood confers a natural lifespan of extraordinary length, and the Condess had every intention of enjoying this lifespan to its very last second. She implemented an unofficial new policy. New Tyrian hatchlings, rather than being given the prettiest dresses, were to be culled immediately on emergence from the caverns, before they were in any condition to put up a fight. This was very simple and tremendously effective. The Condess had been on her throne for 413 solar sweeps. The change of policy was not made known to the empire at large. In fact, steps were taken to ensure that nobody really noticed the difference. Every so often, a particularly healthy and attractive young girl from the next caste down would be taken into the empress's care. Much would be made of her smiling and waving from palace balconies. Eventually she would challenge the empress, as was the way of things, and inevitably she would lose. Only Tyrian blood could stand up to an empress at the height of her powers. You might as well have put a rust blood in the ring. But because she had gill flaps and good hair and her eyes were still clear, and because it wasn't like anyone could just ask for a blood sample, the subterfuge went unsuspected. As far as the Alternian public was concerned, a legitimate challenger had arisen, and the Condess had merely proven once again that she was the toughest motherfucker on the block, which was good for the Empire, surely. All of this information was downloaded to an increasingly astonished Salix captor by a perky fish girl with distracting cleavage during the strangest buffet lunch of his entire life. "So, hold on," he said, as she refilled his coffee from a tall metal jug. "How come you're not dead?" "I got lucky," she said simply, "and then I got smart. The system she uses to scan for new Tyrian births somehow missed me, somehow. Once I was old enough to learn what was going on, I tried my best to stay undercover." She glanced fondly at her Moiril, who was hovering near the sandwiches, looking simultaneously nervous and disdainful. Eridan's been such a help. I couldn't have lasted this long without him." Sulux had already decided Feferi Pixie's Moiril was a douchebag. He was a purple blood, and something in government, and he was gazing at his new set of hive guests with the slightly queasy expression of a man wondering whether to put down traps or poison. "So, why move now?" Sulux asked. The coffee was really good. "If you've been under the radar this long, why start taking risks?" "Because it's not fair," she said passionately. "Nothing's ever going to change or get any better for anyone. We're just going to keep on conquering people until we run out of planets, and there's so much awful stuff happening out there in the Empire, and no one's doing anything about it. We need an Empress who will actually, you know, try and fix things, not just leave them to get worse." "And that's you, huh?" he said. Two purple spots were burning high on her cheeks. She sighed. "I don't know, but I have to try. Is that really stupid?" "It's, what the hell was he meant to say? No, I mean, it's cool that, you know, you want to make a difference." She smiled. "You think it's really stupid." He shrugged helplessly and nearly spilled the coffee. "Look, Princess, you don't fucking want advice from me. I'm not big on the politics stuff. They brought me in to do a job." "Thank you," she said, and it was so painfully sincere that he wanted to grab the fork off her plate and drive it through his own eyeball as hard as he could. "I really appreciate your help." "Oh, look," he said lamely, "cake," and fled. Half an hour later, they were back in the fancy drawing room where they'd started, sitting on high-backed armchairs upholstered in soft purple leather, listening to Terezi Peropi. Sulux was still trying to get a read on her. She was a petite teal blood, about his age, with pointy features and a wide, fanged smile. He'd initially rolled his eyes at her scarlet mirror shades, and then been forced to reconsider when he'd seen her from the side and realized the lenses were surgically implanted into her face. That wasn't any old hipster pretension at work, like the olive blood kids with weird piercings who sometimes came slumming down to Low City to sample life on the street. He wondered if it was a medical thing or just a drastic fashion statement. Either way, he had to admit the effect was pretty intimidating. She had hair cut shoulder length, and neat little horns, and something in the way she moved transmitted a kind of sparse, elegant efficiency. Martial arts training for sure, and he strongly suspected ex-military. She had very sharp elbows. "The operation is essentially quite straightforward," she said briskly. They were sitting in a rough horseshoe, facing in, and she was standing with her back to the unlit fireplace. Dark-veined marble scrolls twined behind her to a huge mantelpiece higher than her head. Feferi had vanished immediately after lunch. He wondered if she was being deliberately kept clear of the nitty-gritty. Idealists, in his experience, didn't mesh too well with blood and oil. "Our objective is to isolate and gain control of the Imperial AI known as Air." He shivered. This whole thing had a little too much of the fairy story about it. He knew, every hacker knew, the stories about the great AIs, the vast ancient machine intelligences that had supposedly kept the Empire running, behind the scenes, for thousands of sweeps and more. But they weren't something you actually dealt with in any kind of real-life situation. Smart hackers tried to stay clear of AIs altogether, even the little corporate ones on the short leashes. Intellect far beyond organic thresholds, coupled with a total lack of anything resembling morality, was not a combination you wanted to lock horns with. Sulux had dealt with a couple in his time, reluctantly. But the great AIs were different. There was nothing to get a grip on, even conceptually. It was like pulling a cutter out of some Low City dive bar, handing him a shiv, and telling him his mark was her imperious condescension. There was a fundamental error of scale involved, somehow. The AIR AI, Peropi went on, was originally conceived as a defensive system. Its purpose was to safeguard the imperial succession by whatever means necessary, hence the name. When the current empress decided to take the succession into her own hands, she was forced to, in some way, impede or disable AIR, since her actions would have led her into direct conflict with its parameters. She would, essentially, have registered as an enemy to the throne, despite her status. The AIR protects the Empire, put in Kanaya, not the Empress. Peropi gave her a little bow. Precisely. Thank you, Miss Mariam. Our belief is that if AIR can be reactivated, it will become more or less impossible for the Condess to maintain her stranglehold on the throne. What's it gonna do? Asked Circuit, who was slumped all the way down in her chair so that her head was almost level with her knees. Kill her? Unclear, said Peropi. Its own axioms almost certainly prevent it from taking direct physical action against the reigning empress, but there are any number of ways it could make her life considerably more difficult. She grinned. It wasn't an entirely pleasant grin. It could, for example, disable every single security system in the Imperial Palace. The point is that whatever happens, the Empress will no longer be in any position to suppress or override a direct challenge from a successor. If Lady Pyxes were to make her existence known tomorrow, she would be very quietly killed. We are not attempting to assassinate the Empress merely to make her vulnerable to legal challenge, as, in fact, she should be, under the laws of the Empire. Wait up, said Salix. What happens if Pyxes can't take her? Empora jerked forward like he'd been stung. You just watch your fucking mouth, you... Lord Empora, please. Peropi held up a hand, looking mildly pained. Mr. Captor's point is valid. The Empress might, of course, succeed in defeating Lady Pyxes even in legitimate combat, which would be terribly regrettable. However, she will not be able to sustain her rule indefinitely against a series of challengers. Once her advantage is removed, she will fall to the next successor, or the next after that. Remember, no empress has ever maintained the throne for more than 100 sweeps unaided. She grinned again. And even a Tyrian must be starting to feel the weight of age after all this time. Can we move on to the fucking plan already? Complained Circuit. I'm bored. Another little bow. My apologies, Miss Circuit. Maintaining your interest is my highest personal priority. Salix bit down a smile. The data cores of the AIR AI are stored at an Imperial site approximately 70 clicks to the north of Villa Empora. I am not a specialist in the medium, but it is my understanding that the strength of the intrusion countermeasure electronics utilized by Imperial facilities makes a frontal assault unfeasible. Mr. Captor, can you confirm that? She turned to look at him. Everyone else did, too. Startled, he sat up a bit higher in his armchair. There's no chance. Imperial ice is some really fucked up shit. I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot cull spike, and any other asshole you got in here would say the same. They've got viruses that can literally blow your head off. Peropi grimaced. Yes, that was the impression I had gained. This means any successful incursion would need to access the system from inside, correct? He scratched his ear. Well, yeah, if you had direct interface with the root systems, it's a different story. Ice is like any other defensive structure, 90% of the shit points outwards. Tunnel up from underneath and, yeah, it wouldn't be easy, but you could do it. To be more specific, Mr. Captor, she said, could you do it? They were all still looking at him. Empora's expression was contemptuous. Circuit's was eager. Kanaya looked, if anything, worried. Peropi was regarding him with her head tilted a little to the side. He cracked his knuckles. Any system you can get me inside, he said firmly, I can tear to fucking shreds. There was a slight but perceptible release of tension. Something in Kanaya seemed to settle. Circuit slapped a hand on one denim-clad knee. Parope just nodded in satisfaction. "Excellent," she said. "The answer I expected. The question then becomes, how are we to provide Mr. Captor with the direct access he needs? Here we have a distinct advantage in the form of Lord Empora, whose position in government gives him a considerable degree of access to Imperial facilities." She twitched her head in Empora's direction. "In 2 weeks' time, Lord Empora will enter the databanks on some suitable pretext, accompanied by Ms. Circuit and Ms. Mariam. They will locate an access point and use remote uplink to connect Mr. Captor to the building's systems, from where he will hopefully be able to locate the air data cores." Suddenly, the sixth member of the group leant forwards in his chair. Selex had pinned Equius Zahak as an engineer the second he laid eyes on the guy, and he hadn't been wrong. Zahak was about 7 feet tall, heavily built, with straight, greasy hair that hung halfway down his back, and an expression that made him look like he was trapped in an eternal private struggle not to punch things. He wore a sleeveless vest and baggy cargo shorts festooned with pockets, several of which evidently held bits of tech and assorted junk. A spool of colored wire stuck out here, the yellow plastic handle of a crosshead screwdriver there. He also seemed to have some kind of perspiration problem. The room was, if anything, cold, big picture windows letting in a stiff breeze from off the darkened sea, and yet every visible inch of skin on Zahak gleamed with fresh sweat. "There will be alarms," he rumbled. "Once the connection has been made, any unorthodox activity will trigger internal security, regardless of Captor's expertise." Tough to tell if there was a jab there. Engineers and helmsmen traditionally regarded each other with a certain mutual scorn, but Zahak sounded more like he was just stating the facts, and it wasn't like he was wrong. Selex decided to give him the benefit of the doubt, for now. "You are perfectly correct," said Parope happily. "That is why we will not be attempting to carry out a single theft. We will be attempting to carry out two." Everyone stared at her. Even Circuit sat up a few inches. "Here is a problem I was set in my first sweep with the Legislaturature," she said. Selex blinked and mentally slid her peg a few notches higher on the not-to-fuck-with board. "You are tasked with insinuating an agent into a heavily defended hostile city. Circumstances oblige you to airdrop the agent straight into the middle of the city, rather than attempting ground insertion. How do you minimize the chances of the agent's arrival being detected?" There was a puzzled silence. "You could construct some sort of localized signal disruptor," began Zahak uncertainly. "Perhaps if one were to wait for a moonless night?" offered Kanaya. "Bomb it," said Selex flatly. Parope smirked at him. "Light the fucking place up like 12th Perigree," he said. "Right? High orbit barrage, rain down hellfire, aim for infrastructure and administration, government buildings, storage depots, sewage works, whatever. Use incendiaries and anything else that's going to take time to clear up. If you throw the whole city into chaos, no one's going to spot one guy parachuting into the middle of it." "Mr. Captor," she said, "see me afterwards for a cookie. Yes, a candle in a dark room will always be obvious, however hard you try to hide it. So turn the lights on. Imperial security is notorious for overreacting. Once we are connected to the mainframe, we will carry out, in effect, a dummy heist. It doesn't particularly matter what we target. Something big. The facility's systems will respond by flashing every light, sounding every alarm, scrambling every guard, and generally causing a great deal of unnecessary fuss." She turned, and the red mirrors locked onto Circuit, who was still slumped in her chair, but starting to look, reluctantly, interested. At this point, Miss Circuit, who is renowned across much of Alternia for her ability to cause chaos, something in the tone, he wasn't sure what, "will stage your dramatic escape." Circuit's lenses revolved thoughtfully. "How dramatic?" she asked. Parope spread her arms wide. "As dramatic as you can make it. I give you free rein on the choreography, but I would suggest a bare minimum of 6 explosions and 1 motorcycle chase. A rooftop confrontation might not go amiss. She frowned. Although, now I come to think of it, I suppose it will be difficult for you to maintain the attention of so many guards without backup of some sort. Bullshit, said Circuit, with a little toss of her head. You want them distracted? They'll be fucking distracted. Wigglers won't know what hit 'em. I'm not sure I understand, put in Konaya politely. If Lord Emporia is to gain access to the building, and Vriska is to provide an irresistible target, what is my role? Security, the Lacerator replied. I assume Mr. Captor will require a certain amount of time to locate and reactivate air. Miss Circuit's distraction should account for most of the guards, but some may remain on patrol. Your job will be to deal quickly and discreetly with anyone who tries to interrupt the uplink process. Is that acceptable? Of course, said Kanaya. Thank you for the clarification, and sat back. Parope scanned the half-circle of chairs, slowly. The lenses made her expression entirely inscrutable. Ladies and gentlemen, she said, 0 hour is 10 p.m. 2 weeks from tonight. We have a lot of work to do. Let's begin. Villa Empora was a pretty good place for a vacation. Salux adopted the ground floor breakfast room as his base of operations. It was big and cool, with tall panoramic windows stretching up to a high stuccoed ceiling, and it had its own coffee maker, and it looked out onto the ocean. Whenever he ran out of ideas, he buzzed out of the medium and sat in his chair, staring out at the pink and green glimmer of the moons on the water and the blue-black, ghostly shapes of the pine trees leaning slowly in the wind, and thought about the girl with the white skin and the dark eyes. Sometimes it even helped. She turned up almost every time he slept now, and it was beginning to fray his nerves. The dreams were always weirdly vivid, and always seemed to end up with him spluttering awake in the sopor, panicked and disoriented. Sometimes it happened 3 or 4 times a day, and then he'd be dopey the next evening, and he'd have to spike his espresso intake, and that meant he kept having to buzz out every half hour to go for a piss, and it really threw him off his game. The images stayed with him, too. In one dream, he'd been standing at the bottom of a huge tree, a smooth gray trunk as wide as he was tall, staring up into the branches. She was sitting about 20 feet above him in a black dress and a bright pink waist sash, hands on the branch either side of her. "Are you trying to look up my dress?" she'd asked, sounding more interested than anything. "No," he'd said, outraged. "I'm trying to climb this fucking tree." "Why?" she'd asked. And when he hadn't been able to think of an answer, she'd plucked a little dark fruit like a fat cherry off the nearest bough and dropped it on him. It had hit him square on the nose and bounced clear, and he'd sat clean upright in the cocoon, coughing warm sopor over his knees. Another time they'd been sitting in Tinkerbell's at the corner table, except it was the middle of the day, the street outside lit up scorched and unreal, and he flinched back into his bench on instinct. She was drinking a glass of wine. He'd turned to the bar and said, "Hey, Tav, pull the fucking blinds, would you?" But the only person behind the counter was Parope, the Legislacerator, and she'd smiled at him, and sticky blood had started to dribble down from beneath the lenses, except the blood was bright red, too, which was really fucked up. And he'd come scrabbling back to consciousness and tried to be sick over the side of the cocoon, but all he got was dry heaves and a nasty taste in his mouth. Being awake was better. The work was interesting. He was trying to build a few subroutines to take care of the dummy heist. Not an AI, but a program that behaved sufficiently like an AI to make the facility's autonomics shit themselves. His idea was that if he could delegate the fake run to robots, it would free up more of his time to tackle air, which he suspected wasn't going to be too easy. He lived on coffee, cigarettes, and those hard little gingery biscuits that the villa's kitchen seemed to keep in crates somewhere. They were delicious, and they never ran out. After the first 4 times, he went nosing into the kitchens hungrily. The cook started just leaving out a dish of them in the breakfast room. Every other evening he'd wake to find a mug of coffee waiting, sticky sweet and nearly cold, but he drank it anyway. Eating mind honey off the spoon made your teeth fall out, or so Kanaya warned him. He stayed mostly clear of the others. Circuit was a pain in the ass. She had a set of 8 blue dice, sharp little crystals the color of cobalt, and a habit of rolling them with a ludicrous prophetic solemnity, like a soothsayer casting the bones. She'd scatter them on the glossy wood of a table so they jumped and bounced and clattered to a stop, and then peer at them like entrails, pick one up and re-roll, swap their places, tut or snigger. It didn't even seem to be a game. She just liked fiddling with the things. Ray had dabbled in cards for a couple of months, and he'd always found it somewhere between cute and impressive. She'd sit cross-legged on the floorboards in her underwear, combing the deck slowly between one hand and the other, and finally stop and lay a card with infinite care. Then she'd give him the spiel. The clock, duty, rhythms, cycles, sacrifice. The tower, life, growth, dreams, the future. The rose, illusion, solitude, violent death. He seemed to get that one a lot. But the cards were quiet, and Ray wouldn't take them out in public. Circuit's dice never left her hand, and the more people were in the room, the harder she threw them. Between that and her crowing laugh and her weirdly affected vowels and her stupid catchphrases, 30 seconds in her company left him wanting to bite through his own arm. Ampora, though, was infinitely worse. The guy's problem was apparent. He was the worst cast snob Salix had ever had the misfortune to encounter. He was almost polite to Zahak, despite the fact that the big engineer broke an average of 3 items of crockery a day, made a colossal fucking mess of the garage, and left damp patches of sweat wherever he sat down. Circuit he acknowledged, Parope and even Kanaya he tolerated, though with spectacularly bad grace. But there was clearly some part of his brain that simply couldn't comprehend why a pissblood was walking around his hive and no one had shot it yet. Every time Salix walked into a room, Ampora's lip actually physically curled in horror. Salix itched to flip him the bird and moonwalk out of there, but he didn't want to risk sending signals. Instead, he just kept to himself, chain-smoked, and got on with his work. 3 nights into the stay, he got company regardless. He'd been messing around in the medium, stitching chunks of code together, and he'd buzzed out to grab more coffee. He spun on his chair, and there was the Legislacerator, perched on a stool at the breakfast bar, staring straight at him. He jolted physically up out of the seat, and every internal organ north of his belt seized up for a moment. "Holy shit," he said. "Fucking don't do that. I mean, sorry. Fuck, I didn't hear anyone come in. What's up?" "I'm sorry," she said, sounding genuinely contrite. "Am I disturbing you?" No, it's cool. Sorry, when I'm buzzed in, I don't have much in the way of peripheral. Wasn't expecting you is all. What do you need?" She seemed a little surprised. "Oh, I don't need anything. I just wanted somewhere quiet to sit." "It's a big hive," he said, surprised himself, and then his pan caught up with his mouth and he winced. "Shit, I didn't mean it like that." "No," she said, half rising. "You're right. I should let you work." No, fuck. Sit down. I was about to have a break anyway. I just meant, like, didn't they give you a thinking room? I kind of assumed since you were in charge you'd have a mind palace or something." She grinned and settled back onto the stool, to his relief. "So I can sit and do creepy Legislacerator meditation, you mean?" "Well, something like that." "Lord Ampora kindly provided me with an office, but I don't like it. It's too quiet." He raised an eyebrow. "I thought you just said..." Yes, I know." She pulled a face. "It's complicated. I want silence, but not total silence. I'm not used to it. I want somewhere with ambient noise, but no talking or music or anything like that. Here I have the wind in the trees outside, and the sea, and your claws going tappy-tap-tap." Another broad grin. "It's perfect, and I can feel the breeze, which is nice." He nodded. Hell of a view, too. I just end up staring out the window sometimes. That is less of a concern, she said dryly, for me.
Yeah?
Yes, I am immune to even the loveliest of moonlight vistas, largely because I am completely blind. He stared at her. I imagine you are staring at me with a silly expression, she said. Unfortunately, I am immune to even the silliest of lanky nerd double takes due to an aforementioned issue re my vision.
Wait a fucking second, he said. You're jerking my chain.
That is a weirdly sexual turn of phrase, and no, I am not. She was grinning yet again. The predatory grin, he was starting to realize, was essentially her default. Her face actually relaxed into it. He wondered if she grinned in her sleep, then immediately wondered why the fuck he'd wondered that. I have no idea how many fingers you are holding up.
I'm not holding up any fingers.
You see? She delivered a theatrical sigh. I am a hopeless case. The culling forks await.
No, no, back up. This is bullshit. You're a fucking legislacerator.
Technically, she said mildly. I was a fucking legislacerator.
Why'd you quit?
Well, as it happens, I have a little problem. He pinched the bridge of his nose.
Shit. Sorry. Okay, just got it. I've been in the medium for 3 hours. You're lucky I'm forming words.
He remembered the coffee suddenly and hauled himself out of the chair. Did you call me a lanky nerd just now?
Nope. Pretty sure.
She looked solemn. You've been in the medium for 3 hours. You've begun to hallucinate. You should probably take a break.
Thank fuck, he said, crossing to the coffee maker and noticing, for the first time, that her head didn't turn to follow him. If you'd called me a lanky nerd, I'd have had to kill your skinny ass.
And I would have been entirely defenseless, she agreed sadly, because...
There's this whole situation going on with your optic nerves. Yeah, so I heard.
Do you really think my ass is skinny?
He poured the coffee over the table. Fuck, I haven't been looking at your ass. Sorry, been too busy.
Well, good, she said. I haven't been looking at yours either.
That's because you don't fucking know where it is.
At that, to his astonishment, she threw back her head and guffawed, a wild, scratchy, full-body laugh of utter glee, so at odds with her clipped little movements and careful walk that he nearly laughed, too, from sheer surprise. Then she reached into the top pocket of her jacket and produced a bright red ballpoint pen. She weighed it in one hand, like a dart, and threw it at him. He jerked reflexively to the side, and it bounced off his hip bone and fell to the floorboards with a clatter. How did I do? She said, grinning so wide it threatened to wrap all the way around her head.
Okay, this whole thing was a con, he said. No way you're blind.
I really am, she said. I just have an excellent personal radar. He mopped at the table with a stack of paper napkins.
That's not excellent. That's fucking weird. Do you want a coffee?
Yes, please. Milk and lots of sugar. It's lacerator training, mostly. We do blind fighting and second sweep, echolocations, 360 sensitivity, all that kind of thing. But I picked up an advantage when I had my unfortunate accident. He brought the mug over and held it out, handle towards her. She did, in fact, hesitate very slightly when she took it. The glitch was fractional, and if he hadn't been watching, he'd have missed it. But it was there, a tiny stutter before her fingers closed, a half-second's course correction.
Yeah, he said. I guess you'd have to get good pretty fast.
She sipped the coffee. He watched, taking the opportunity to study her more openly than he'd have dared before. He'd never seen a lacerator up close. From a distance, once, during a job which could have gone badly south. He'd been 8 sweeps and stupid, still trying to do things the cool way, not the smart way, and he hadn't learnt the vital skill of checking a situation out before you jumped in feet first.
He'd hurled himself at the problem, secure in his immortality. Those days it had been all about the problem, all about what broke first, it or him, and hadn't paid attention, and several people had died, and he'd nearly been one of them. One dreadful dawn, he'd huddled on a rooftop in the rain and watched a tall figure in a trench coat walk past along the street below, and, as it stopped and looked around, he'd believed, for a wild second, every single story, that the legislacerators were grown in special vats, that they felt no pain, that they could smell a lie and hear a beating heart. This one was small and spiky, and slurping at a mug of milky coffee between her hands like it was the only thing in all the galaxy she cared about. Her claws were neat and yellow against the white ceramic. Her chin came to an actual point, and her hair curled down in little apostrophes at her temples. She'd hit him with a ballpoint pen from 15 feet away and hadn't even seemed to think about the throw. She liked silence, but not too much silence. She was almost certainly the most dangerous person in a building that currently held not only Kanaya Mariam, but an heir to the Alternian throne, and he was pretty sure she'd been flirting with him just now. She looked up. The steam from the coffee had misted up her lenses. "How are you getting on with the mind, honey?" she asked.
"Pretty good. It's weird stuff."
"How so?"
He thought about this one for a moment. "Okay. Since the crash, my accident, I've had a few problems, you know. Some days I can't get the right distance from things. I'm too close or I'm too far off. When I need to work, I just take pills to get around it. So if I'm trying to see the big picture, but I can't stop my brain chewing on some pointless fucking loop of code, I pop a bubble, right?"
"Pop a what?"
she said curiously. "Oh, dream bubbles. Sorry. Erythromorphine. It's a disassociative. Lets you kind of step back and see everything at once." He didn't say hallucinogen. "Or if I need to crunch a problem but I keep floating off, I take cyanoephedrine to dial myself back in."
"Like changing the focus on a camera?"
"Yeah, exactly," he said, pleased. "Since I started on the honey, though, I haven't had to take a single pill. It's like my autofocus kicked back in. I can change levels like I used to before the crash."
"That must be a great relief."
"Fucking right. But, I mean, I've been on this stuff less than a week. No way I should be seeing this kind of change." He ran one palm nervously down the stubble along his jaw. "I'm not sure if I'm on the world's longest trip or if that shit's rewired my brain for good or what." She pulled a face and took another noisy slurp of coffee.
"I wish I could help, but the military didn't let its psychics anywhere near mind, honey. Our supplies were very tightly restricted."
"Not surprised," he said. "It's fucking toxic as hell if you actually have a brain, not just a heap of old screws and tofu keeping your ears apart. Lucky me, huh?" He sighed. "Look, I need to get back to work."
"Should I leave you alone?"
"No, it's cool. Stick around. I won't even notice you when I'm buzzed in, like I say."
"Thank you," she said. "It is nice in here."
He sat back down at the table, massaged his forehead with splayed fingers for a couple of seconds, and then unhooked the jack and pushed it home. As the medium formed around him, his neck prickled. He looked to his left, on some instinct, and for a moment he was sure he saw a figure, small and distant, walking away from him along the sweeping green glass arch of an exokernel. It had a wild mane of hair and tall horns, and animal terror clutched tight at his protein chute for no reason at all. Then it was gone. He buzzed out.
"Huh," he said. His hands were trembling a little on the keyboard. "Shit."
"What's wrong?" said Terezi, from the other side of the room.
"Nothing." He smoothed one hand down the back of his head. "Think I just saw an ICP.
"A what?"
He swiveled the chair to face her, even though he knew it didn't matter, and lit a cigarette so his hands had something to do.
"ICP, he said. "Inexplicable cyberspace phenomenon. People see him if they've been buzzed in for too long sometimes, but I never."
"Huh. You never heard of him?"
She looked puzzled.
I don't think so. I don't use computers much. They're mostly bullshit. It's like hacker mythology, almost. They're what we have instead of fairy stories. There's a whole archive down Durst that tries to keep track of them all. The ICP wiki writes little articles and everything. The server that ate people, the webcomic that takes over your brain, or the Dark Carnival. You heard of that one? Possibly. It's something about clowns? Yeah. He took a drag on the cigarette and breathed out slowly, starting to feel better. Story goes some fucking incredible helmsman back in the day was bouncing around the net doing whatever when he found this weird node he'd never seen before. Didn't even have any ice or anything, just sitting there. So he dived in, which was a pretty rookie fucking move, if you ask me. But anyway, and instead of some old file cache, he ended up in this weird, kind of deserted fairground. You know, broken down rides, signs creaking in the wind, generic creepypasta shit. He tapped the ash into his coffee mug. Terezi was leaning forward, listening intently. So he figures it's a social hub that someone with a fucked up sense of humor got to work on. He goes for a poke around, and at this point you can basically go nuts on the story, add in a hive of horrors, or candy apples made of heads, or shit, fucking zombies if you want. Point is, dude flips his pan. By the time he freaks for good and buzzes out, he's a gibbering wreck. Buzzes back in later, can't find the fucking thing, spends perigees just wandering the medium, and then starts getting his friends to come and help him look. Couple of sweeps down the line, he dies in some ridiculous spooky way, you know, like suffocates in a vat of candy floss or laughs too hard at a cracker joke and suffers a catastrophic hernia. But by then there's a bunch of other idiots all devoting their lives to finding the Dark Carnival. He swept his hand angrily outwards, accidentally scattering more ash. Total horseshit. It's practically a religion in some parts of Low City. You get these assholes staggering around, puffing on Faygo bongs, and mumbling about how sweet it's gonna be when they find the carnival, bro. And no one's ever found it? Said Terezi. She seemed openly fascinated by the story. Her lenses gleamed. He felt a slight shiver of unaccustomed pleasure at someone actually giving a shit at what he had to say. Nah, I mean, for all I know, there is some kind of abandoned hub out there that got hacked to look like a horror show. That's a big place. But the stories got told about it are just fucking dumb. Make it sound like it was a real place, not a virtuality. And, I mean, what are these morons gonna do when they find it? Walk around it shitting themselves? Probably, she agreed. People who have never actually been scared always like to be scared. He looked at her. Then he dropped the remains of the cigarette in the coffee mug, where it hissed briefly. Hey, he said. Can I ask you a question? Of course. This, he said, and stopped, spread his hands awkwardly, realized she couldn't see it. This thing we're doing, the job, it's crazy, right? It's not just me. She tilted her head to the side, considered him. In what way? I don't know, just the size of this fucking thing. He felt again that same sense of overwhelming helplessness, like a climber at the base of a smooth wall that just went straight up and didn't stop. I mean, we're literally plotting to dethrone the Empress. I can't even say that shit without wanting to laugh. You're worried the job is too difficult? No, fuck, I've taken some ridiculous jobs in my time. It's not that it's hard, it's just... It seems kind of out of proportion somehow, he said lamely, regretting opening his mouth. One day I'm in a shitty bar drinking cheap beer, the next I'm taking orders off, no offense, a fucking legislacerator. Ex-legislacerator. Yeah, okay, and I'm sitting in a mansion trying to work out how to jumpstart an imperial AI, you know? She said nothing for several seconds. Then she said, quietly, Yes, I do know, but it's the job. He nodded. Yeah, I'm not trying to quit or anything. I just kind of wanted to vent. Sorry. Don't apologize. As a matter of fact, I agree with you. I have been a very long way from Alternia and done some very strange things. And this one seems a little daunting, she sighed. But I have found that when climbing a high mountain, it is generally best not to look up. He blinked, but didn't mention the eerie way she'd picked up his own analogy. Must help, then, being blind. She grinned delightedly. I told you I had an advantage.